From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
And it's so fortunate for them that they are destined to live in this land of ice and snow, where they are not subject to the vices and diseases of civilization. Robert Peary wrote those words in May of 1898.
Despite the polar explorer's words, the Inuit, who live in the northwest coast of Greenland, find themselves at the center of Bush's plans for a new Star Wars weapon system.
The next war will not be fought by guns. The next war will be who is pushing the switch of nuclear devices. And we know that the Thule Air Base will be a main target for the enemy when the war comes.
Today we go to the top of the world for an exclusive interview with the Inuit leader of the Abandoned. It's not the first time the U.S. has had an impact on their lives. We'll also hear the story of Minik, an Inuit boy who with his father and four others was taken to the Museum of Natural History in New York to be put on display. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. In Sydney, Australia this morning, a group of Colombian citizens took over the Colombian consulate for several hours in a protest against Plan Colombia and U.S. policy toward their country. About 100 heavily armed riot police immediately surrounded the consulate, but the demonstration ended peacefully when the 15 Colombians, including several children, left the consulate. They were briefly detained and then released. A spokesperson for the group, which called itself the Bolivar Movement for the Second Independence of Colombia, said, "We are protesting against Plan Colombia. We are protesting against the Yankee invasion of Latin America and the American invasion of Colombia." A federal judge yesterday ordered the government to reveal the high-tech computer snooping technique used by the FBI to gather evidence against an alleged mobster. Privacy advocates say the computer monitoring techniques violate the Fourth Amendment. The case is believed to be the first in the nation in which federal agents installed a secret surveillance system in a personal computer system under search warrant and the first to be tested in U.S. courts. The New York Times is reporting today that a group of federal judges in San Francisco has begun a low-level insurrection against government monitoring of their private computers. The judges who preside in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, the nation's largest appeals court, began disabling their computer monitoring software in May. The judges argued the monitoring was illegal, unethical, and constituted a major violation of their privacy. The conflict between the circuit judges and the administrative office of the courts, a small bureaucracy in Washington, deteriorated to a point that a council of the circuit's appeals and district judges ordered their technology staff to disconnect the monitoring program on May 24th for a week until a temporary compromise was reached. Because the Ninth Circuit's was also linked to the Eighth and Tenth Circuits, the shutdown affected about a third of the country and about 10,000 court employees, including more than 700 active and semi-retired judges. The case is significant because these are the same judges who are increasingly ruling on legal challenges to surveillance in the workplace and public spaces. The Judicial Conference of the United States, the ultimate governing body of the U.S. District Courts, will meet on September 11th to resolve the matter. This news from Tegucigalpa, Honduras. Amnesty International asked Honduras yesterday to investigate the murders of more than 800 children and young people during the past 3.5 years in Honduras. According to the rights group Casa Alianza, which works with street children in Mexico and Central America, 820 young Hondurans were killed between January 1998 and June 2001. Many youngsters were killed by gunshots to the head at close range. Few of the killers have been identified or arrested. Government officials attribute the violence to territorial disputes between rival maras or youth gangs, but human rights groups say the crimes are committed by death squads linked to the police. This news from Turkey. Turkish police detained 131 Islamist protesters in Istanbul on the eve of a one-day visit by Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. Officers in riot gear detained women wearing Islamic headscarves as the protesters gathered in front of a high school to demonstrate against Israel's assassination of Palestinians and other hardline Israeli policies. Predominantly Muslim but strictly secular Turkey has been Israel's main regional ally since 1996, when the two signed a military cooperation accord, much to the anger of most Arab countries and Iran. Editors of 11 leading medical journals from around the world say they've agreed to a new policy for reporting research sponsored by drug companies. One of the editors explained that under the new policy, they will question papers listing academic scientists as lead authors when the studies were actually designed and the data analyzed by drug company scientists. The policy is meant to address a practice in which university scientists are used as window dressing to lend credibility to papers that are really the work of drug companies. The journals are keeping the wording of their new policy secret until early September.
Would you harbor me? Would I harbor you? Would you harbor me? Would I harbor you? A heretic, convict, or spy? Would you harbor a runaway woman or child, a poet, a prophet, a king? Would you harbor an exile or a refugee, a person living with a harbor, a Tubman, a Garrett, a truth, a fugitive, or a slave? Would you harbor a Haitian, Gloryan, or Czech, a lesbian, or a gay? Would you harbor a Christian, a Muslim, a heretic, convict, or spy? Would you harbor a runaway woman or child, a poet, a prophet, a king? Would you harbor an exile or a refugee, a person living with?
Would you harbor me, sweet honey in the rock, here on Democracy Now! Refuge Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. 56 years ago this week, the U.S. dropped the first two atomic bombs and the nuclear age was born. Now we're witnessing the birth of the militarization of space, the military space age. On Monday, the anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima, Democracy Now! Began a series on the nuclear and space age, which culminates tomorrow with the anniversary of the bombing of Nagasaki. So far, we've heard from a survivor of the attack on Hiroshima, as well as a Native American woman whose mother died of cancer after working in the uranium mines in New Mexico. We heard from a prominent MIT physicist who says the Pentagon is trying to silence him for arguing that missile defense system doesn't work. And yesterday, Professor Noam Chomsky, who says that what supporters call national missile defense is actually an offensive weapon that could lead to a new global arms race. Well, today we go to the top of the world, to the Arctic, to the Thule Air Base on the northwestern coast of Greenland. The base is United States Space Command Station, where 1,500 military personnel labor to provide the Pentagon with advance warning of airborne attack. If President Bush has his way, it'll become one of two bases outside the U.S., the others in Yorkshire, England, that'll play a key role in his Son of Star Wars scheme. But the military personnel aren't the only ones living in the area. The Inuit people, who we know better as the Eskimos, lived in Greenland long before the Americans ever arrived. In the 50s, a group of Inuit were forcibly evicted to make room for the base. In the 60s, a U.S. B-52 bomber carrying four hydrogen bombs crashed on the ice, spewing radioactive debris across the snow. Despite cleanup attempts, the Americans and Danes have admitted that enough plutonium for a whole bomb was never recovered. Now the Inuit are demanding the Americans and Danes clean up the land and are suing the Danish government to reclaim their sacred hunting grounds. In a minute, we will speak with one of the Inuit leaders in his first ever interview for the United States. But we start now with Dan Hinsgall, who's a disarmament campaigner for Greenpeace, and Steve Boggan, the chief reporter for the British newspaper The Independent. They're speaking to us from the Greenpeace ship Arctic Sunrise, which is anchored just off the coast of Greenland, across from Thule Air Base. Currently, three Greenpeace activists are trying to break into the base. Steve Boggan, you wrote this incredible piece in yesterday's Independent. Can you begin by telling us the story of the U.S. military and the Inuit people?
Well, after the war in 1946, the United States, with the permission of the Kingdom of Denmark, which governs Greenland, wanted to establish a weather station. So they arrived, first of all, with one plane, according to local Inuit people who still remember this. Then with several others that circled, and finally with a large seaplane from which some airmen were dispatched and talked to the local Inuit people, and they actually seem to recall they gave them apples and told them everything would be okay. Shortly afterwards, the first ships came along and laid an airstrip, made a weather station. But then between about 1951 and 53, the militarization of the base began. And in 1953, the 47 families that occupied the area were told that they would have to leave to make way for surface-to-air missile batteries. They were, I've spoken to a number of people here who still remember this, that their stories, when I interview them separately, all tally. Basically, they say that they were told by the village priest who'd been summoned to Denmark that the Danish government wanted them to move. They were told that they had 48 hours to move to a place called Karnak, which is on the coast approximately 100 miles to the north, and they were told that houses were waiting for them there. But they were also told that the people who didn't move immediately wouldn't get a house. So the people I've spoken to say that they packed up their belongings, put them on their dog sleds, and headed north across the ice. The immediate coastline was frozen at the time. They headed north across the ice to Karnak. When they arrived there, the houses that they'd been promised hadn't been built, and for 3 months they had to live in tents. So from that moment onwards, they've been largely forgotten.
And then tell us what happened in 1968 with the B-52 bomber going down.
Sure, there was a B-52 Stratofortress. It wasn't en route to the base, but apparently it was in distress, and that was the nearest place it could land. It attempted to land, and it fell some way short. Didn't quite make it. Fell into an area called Bylot Sound. Now, there were some explosions, not nuclear explosions, but enough to blow the plane to pieces and to completely fragment the bombs on board. Now, there was a cleanup operation, and the surface snow and ice was removed by quite a large number of workers, and everybody was told that this was effective. But in fairly recent times, the Danish government and the U.S. government have admitted that somewhere between 0.8 and 1.5 kilos of plutonium were never recovered. At the upper end of the scale, that's enough, you could argue, to make a whole bomb.
The cleanup report the Danes have kept secret?
Well, no, not all of it. There have been a number of environmental impact studies carried out, and some of them have been released, some of them haven't. There's one report in particular that was drawn to my attention by the environmental group Greenpeace. It's a 4,000-page report commissioned by the Danish government. Ordinarily, they would expect this report to be made public, but it hasn't been. Now, the report isn't expected simply to cover the crash and the effect of the plutonium, but also the effect of having an airbase on a site like this, hundreds of miles from any normal waste disposal facilities, the effect of having this for 40, 50 years, when there are things like oils, diesel, possibly PCBs, which we understand were probably just buried. There were certain silos. It's difficult to tell because obviously you can't go on the base, but it's understood that there were some silos that were filled with certain types of rubbish. This now may well have leached into the environment. The local Inuit report finding seals with no hair, musk oxen with deformed feet, and they say they have found other animals as well with apparent deformities. But of course, until the environmental impact reports are made public, nobody can know for sure what's in them.
You mentioned Greenpeace. I'd like to come back to you, Steve Boggan, but I'd like to get Dan Hinsgal on the telephone, Greenpeace's disarmament campaigner, who is on the Arctic Sunrise with you off the northwestern coast of Greenland. Dan Hinsgal, can you tell us how you got involved with this issue? Where do you come from?
Well, I've been a campaigner with Greenpeace for about 3 years, and I've been involved in the disarmament campaign for the past year. And one of our top priorities for the past year have been to prevent the U.S. from moving ahead with their proposed missile defense system, because we fear that will lead the world into a new nuclear arms race. We've been in Greenland now for 2 weeks. We're going to be here for a month, and we're doing a tour to stimulate the debate up here about the missile defense project. So we're having open bows meeting Greenlanders, and what we'd like to do is to really offer them a platform to speak out, because I believe that in places like the U.S., in Washington, their voices are not being heard.
As a Danish citizen, what has been your government's reaction to your work in Tula, in Greenland?
Well, the position of the Danish government has been the same as in the U.K., because the U.K. have a similar base that will also be used for the missile defense system, which is in Fylingdale in Yorkshire. Both governments have adopted the position that they'll simply wait and see until they get a formal request from the U.S. government to upgrade the radar facilities. We believe that they should act much sooner. We know that the U.S. is now spending more than $8 billion next year on missile defense. Most of it goes into the mid-course project, basically, which is dependent on using facilities at Tula and Fylingdale. So this is the time that they have to speak up, and we're not seeing that right now.
Before we go back to Steve Boggan of The Independent, a quick question about an action earlier this week on Hiroshima Day. What did Greenpeace do?
On Hiroshima Day, we thought we would try to do a remembrance ceremony for the victims of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And what we did was that we went with our ship, which is an icebreaker, into the sea ice, and we got off, and we had one of the crew members, who's quite talented artistically, went off on the ice and created shadows of or outlines of a parent with a child that resembles the one that could be witnessed on the buildings of Hiroshima after the bomb blast, when people were vaporized and their shadows were left as horrible reminders of what had happened on the walls of buildings.
As a Dane, when you were growing up, what did you understand about Denmark's relationship with Greenland and specifically with the Inuit?
Well, I think it's fair to say that the Danish government has not been very fair to the Inuits and to Greenlanders in general. This was a colony until 1953, And actually the area where Toul is located was a protectorate until 61. And in Danish school books you'll find a lot of stories about how Danish government brought welfare and schools and things like that to Greenland. But in reality, as we can witness up here, that has not been the case. And even today, foreign policy matters is still conducted from Copenhagen, and the Greenland Home Rule government does not have a formal say in the decision, although the Danish government have pledged that they will consult with them. But we fear that once again, they may take a decision over their heads.
Dan Hensgaal, finally, you have been, Greenpeace has been trying to get information about the environmental impact of these military programs on Greenland, on Kanak. What kind of success have you had using the Danish Freedom of Information Act?
That's correct. There is a number of environmental studies that have been published. A recent one was drawn to our attention, a 4,000-page environmental assessment report of one dump site on the Dundas Peninsula on the base area, which was actually the place where the Inuits lived before 1953. We got the reply back from the Danish Foreign Ministry that the U.S. government opposes this report being made public, and that they will not also give us access to a Danish memorandum on that report. What we do know is that Danish environmental authorities have found this report to be inadequate, which of course has made us very critical and very curious as to what is actually in that dump site and what do we propose to do with it. It seems that the strategy so far has been to just leave it lying there and perhaps throw some dirt over and hope everybody will forget it. But with these toxic substances, that's really not the way to handle it. And we would like to see the U.S. government clean up after them and pay the bill and do it as soon as possible.
What do you think of the Bush National Missile Defense Plan?
I think that's one of the most dangerous threats to stability and nuclear disarmament in the world right now. This program, if it goes ahead, risks 20 years of progress in nuclear disarmament, and we really would like to see that go forward. And I think the U.S. Has a large responsibility now to really make sure that they roll back this plan. If they want to prevent proliferation of nuclear weapons, this is not the way to do it. We think this will spur proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, and that cannot be in the interest of the U.S. government or the U.S. public. The missile defense plan of Bush will not make the world a safer place.
I wanted to ask you a final question. Steve Boggan again with us. He's on the Greenpeace Arctic Sunrise just off Tula Air Base, northwestern coast of Greenland, chief reporter for The Independent. At the end of the piece that you do on the whole situation of the Inuit in regards to national missile defense, you quote an Inuit man, Mr. Kwavigak. Can you talk about him?
Yes, he was at the time of the movement of the people in 1953. He was, I think from recollection, he was 17. And he describes his parents going to a meeting where they were told they would have to leave. He recalls that they packed up within 48 hours and that there were a lot of tears. He says he remembers that his younger brothers and sisters were all very excited to be moving somewhere, but that their mother and father were crying all the time. He says he also recalls they got on the dog sleds, all their possessions, and they moved some way from their old home. And he says he recalls his father stopping, turning around, and looking back to the old Dundas hunting grounds, which they regarded as being sacred. And his father was crying, and his mother was crying.
Could you read the last quote in your piece from Mr. Kwavigak?
Yes. What he said, and I have to say he was a very, very humble man, a very thoughtful man. He said, "I don't feel bitter towards the Americans, but if Mr. Bush were here now, I would say, Mr. Bush, if God wanted to end the world and to turn the mountains upside down so that they were covered by the sea,
he would do it. He does not need you to do it for him.
That was Steve Boggan, chief reporter for the London newspaper The Independent, quoting Aaron Kavigak, an Inuit who was 12 when the Americans first arrived in 1946. After our break, we'll hear from one of the Inuit themselves, speaking for himself. Steve was joined by Dan Hinsgold, disarmament campaigner for Greenpeace. Again, they're speaking to us off the northwestern coast of Greenland on the Greenpeace ship, Greenpeace Arctic Sunrise. For more information, you can go to their website at www.stopstarwars.org. You're listening to Democracy Now! On Pacifica Radio. Back in a minute.
I'm gonna stay on the battlefield. I'm gonna stay on the battlefield. I'm gonna stay on the battlefield till I
calling out to everyone who would listen, it is time to move us all into another century. Time for freedom and racial and sexual justice. Time for women and children and men. Time for hands unbound.
You are listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Yesterday, we were able to reach by telephone one of the Inuit who was forcibly removed by the Americans in 1953. His name is Usakak Kayokitsak. He is now the president of a group called Hingitak 53, which is translated either as the Organization of the Relocated People from Tula or simply the Abandoned. We go now to the top of the world. This is his first interview for American radio. He will be translated by his son, Vitus. Listen carefully as he tells us his story.
Tässä nähuja tsakta ukuita singa kut imaka tsakta tamahami. Tässä hiviki duaktu huami, bisaaksi dui tai kengani, pingit seri dui, autako kagei teemani mai minit no tsajal tsasimi. Kammat dunia ta nangitsumi te autako uamikki. Iddu takangitsumu maunga, autako tsemagei tangayokka uwa upoang huu teemanikkut.
In May 1953, the people of Tule were told to move to another settlement that lies 150 kilometers further north from Tule. The families were given only a few days' warning to move to a place without any houses or any infrastructure at all.
Can you jump ahead to 1968 when the American B-52 bomber crashed on the ice in Belo Sound near the Tule Air Base? How did that affect you?
Yeah.
I was not there in Tule in 1968 when the plane crashed. I was in Denmark at that time to finish my education. But I came back home during the summer that year. And I was told that my people were the ones that were working and cleaning up near the crash site of the plane. And those people were not told what danger they would expose their li-
life when they were cleaning up the radioactive materials after the plane crash. It is one of our main demands against it is one of our main demands in the case against the Danish state that the people who were exposed at that time were not told for the dangers that they were given when they were cleaning up in the crash site at that time. And we are demanding that there should be a cleaning of the crash site of the plane. And we were not told which risks there would be for the nature and for the people who live around the Thule area. It is only in recent time that we received some reports of how devastating damage there has been in the crash site, and that it is only in recent time that we were told how dangerous it is for us to be in that area.
Did you know of people who died of cancer?
Yes, all the people who were working in the crash site are dead today. they all died of cancer, where they had some very similar symptoms, all of them. And it is clear that they were highly exposed during the cleanup after the plane crash. And we also have some evidence that the plane crash has damaged the area where the plane has crashed, and that the area is heavily exposed of radioactive materials, and we fear that the animals living around the area where the plane crash has destroyed almost all animal life. The area was known for being a place where walruses lived, and there are many birds living around the area, and we fear that the area is so exposed that the animals all will be in danger from being exposed. And we all already have seen some deformed animals, such as seals without fur, and so on. So it is evident that the area is heavily exposed.
We're talking to Usakak Kiyokitsak. He is in Kanak, Greenland. We're talking about his experience, particularly how he's been affected by the U.S. military, which brings me to the question, how do you feel about Bush's plan for what he calls national missile defense, which would be based at Thule?
We haven't received any requests from United States about the missile defense plan, nor have we received any explanation or any hearing from the Danish state regarding the American plans in Thule. Nor has the Greenland government shown any interest of involving the local population to explain what the plans are about, what the United States is planning to do in Thule. But one thing I can say is that all the people in Thule are against the missile defense plan.
Why?
The next war will not be fought by guns. The next war will be who is pushing the switch of nuclear devices. And we know that the Thule Air Base will be a main target for the enemy when the war comes. And we fear that because of that Thule is a target for bombs, that we would be exposed for danger in our country. The war would be so devastating that we no longer would could live in our land around Thule. And we fear that it would be so devastating that it will destroy any living form around Thule. And we are against because we wish to live peacefully in our land and to have a right to use our land.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, I think I have said the most of what I wanted to say. But there is one thing, though, that that I would like to forward you, and that is that we never need the American politicians to confront with us of what their ideas are regarding Thule and so on. So it would be a benefit for all of us if there is a slight interest among the American politicians to meet with us and to tell us what their plans are in our country.
That was Usakak Kuyakitsak, forcibly removed from his home by the Americans in 1953. He's now president of a group called Hingitak 53, which is translated either as the Organization of the Relocated People from Thule or simply as the Abandoned. He spoke to us from Kanak, Greenland. This was his first interview on American radio, and he was translated by his son, Vitus, who is speaking from Nuuk, Greenland. He will be running for the Danish Parliament in the next few months. That is his son. Tomorrow on Democracy Now!, as we continue our series from the nuclear age to the new space age, the militarization of space, with bookends of the bombing of Hiroshima anniversary to tomorrow, the bombing of Nagasaki, we will hear from a survivor of the first ever atomic bomb dropped on Nagasaki, the second atomic bomb ever dropped, and it was dropped by the Americans. Little music break, then we will hear the story of a young Inuit boy who was brought to the United States with his family and put on display at the Museum of Natural History.
You're listening to Democracy Now! Free Speech Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. From the age of polar exploration comes the astonishing untold story of Minik, a young Inuit boy from northwestern Greenland brought to New York in 1897 by the American explorer Robert Peary. Minik, along with his father and four others, was presented to the American Museum of Natural History as one of six Eskimo specimens. Four members of the group, including Minik's father, quickly died of exposure to strains of influenza to which they had little resistance. Another survived and returned to Greenland. During his 12 years as the only Eskimo in New York City, Minik was stared at by the paying public and examined by doctors and scientists. His own life was shattered when he discovered his father's skeleton on display in the Museum of Natural History. Ken Harper has written a book about his story. It's called Give Me My Father's Body, The Life of Minik, the New York Eskimo. Ken Harper has lived in the Arctic for over 30 years in Inuit communities in the Baffin region and in Kanak, Greenland, where we were just speaking to Usakak. Ken Harper has worked as a teacher, development officer, historian, linguist. He speaks Inuktitut, the Eskimo language of the eastern Canadian Arctic, and has written extensively on northern history and the Inuktitut language. When Give Me My Father's Body was first published, I interviewed him. Tell us how you discovered the story of this boy.
Well, in 1977, I was on an extended trip in northwestern Greenland, what's called the Thule District of Greenland, and I was visiting a friend one day, a Greenlander, and the talk turned to history, as it always did when this fellow and I met. And he asked me, have you ever heard of a young boy named Minik that was taken to the United States in 1897 by the American explorer Robert Peary? And I hadn't, and I was surprised that I hadn't. I'd read a lot of northern history, and northern Greenland, despite the fact that the polar Eskimos, as anthropology calls them, are the smallest group of Inuit with a distinctive culture. They've been very well written about by American and Danish explorers, but I'd never heard of this boy, Minik. And so my curiosity was piqued, and I asked him, who is this Minik? And he took from his library shelf a book published some years back in Greenlandic, and it was the diary of the first missionary to northern Greenland in 1909. And he read me this passage from September, and it said, on this day the small ship Jeannie arrived from Newfoundland. On board was a young man, Minik, who had been taken to America by Robert Peary 12 years earlier. He is returning here today with only the clothes on his back. That's the first time I ever heard the name Minik.
Can you talk about what happened and how Minik came to live at the museum and who came with him?
Well, in 1897, Robert Peary made his fourth expedition to northern Greenland. He had this long, obsessive quest to find the North Pole. But in 1897, he went up there to bring back the final one of three meteorites that were the source of meteoric iron for these Inuit. He had brought the other two meteorites back 2 years earlier. So he brought back this large meteorite, and as usual, he employed the Inuit to help him, and they laboriously loaded this thing onto the ship to bring back to the States.
Did they want it to leave their land?
I don't think they wanted it to leave their land. It deprived them completely of any source of iron. But Peary wanted it, and Peary prevailed.
Maybe gives new meaning to the term imperialism.
Imperialism, indeed. The other thing that Peary took with him, though, when he left that summer, he had on board six Inuit from the group. And the reason for this, in May of 1897, Franz Boas, then an anthropologist with the American Museum of Natural History, wrote to Peary and said, I beg to suggest to you that if you are certain that you will be going back to northern Greenland again next year, that then this year we would like you to bring back one adult living Eskimo to be kept here over the winter, to be studied leisurely, so that we could learn scientific information from him and about him. So Peary, for reasons unknown, rather than just bringing back one, he brought back six. He brought back young Minik and his father Kishuk. He brought back a family of three, Nuktak, his wife Atangana, and their daughter Aviak, and he brought back a young man, Wisakasak. And they arrived in New York City in September 30th of that year, and they were kept on board the ship for the first couple of days. 30,000 people came and paid 25 cents each to go on board the ship and see them and the meteorites, and then they were taken away to be housed in the basement of the American Museum of Natural History, where they very quickly became ill.
They lived in the basement of the museum?
Yes, they did, for some time.
And they were put on display?
They were on display. They were exhibited in the museum's basement. But very quickly they took ill. And they had no immunity to the diseases and germs of civilization. Very quickly, they ended up one by one in Bellevue Hospital.
And who were they? Who were these Inuit, what was known then as Eskimos?
Well, they were members of the group that anthropology calls the Polar Eskimos. They were a group whose population numbered less than 250 people. They lived farther north than any other people in the world. Until their isolation had been broken in 1818 by the British explorer John Ross, they actually believed they were the only people in the world. There was no communication between their area and southern Greenland because Melville Bay, which separates that long west coast of Greenland, is pretty much impassable. So these were people who were hunters, polar bear and walrus and seal hunters primarily. They were visited at the time we're talking in this story. They had been visited sporadically by whaling ships, whalers in search of the bowhead whale, who would stop in and trade sporadically with the Inuit. But their lives were changed a great deal in 1891 when Robert Peary came among them for the first time.
And what was their relation to each other? What were their families? How were they connected to each other, these six Eskimos, Inuit, who were brought to New York?
The two adult males, Kishuk and Nuktak, were simply friends who had worked for Peary on his previous expeditions in return for trade goods. So Kishuk brought his son Minik, Nuktak brought his wife and daughter. Wisakasak, the other young man, was not related to any of them, but he had been betrothed to be married eventually to young Aviak when she would be old enough to get married, so that's why he came along.
How many of them got sick?
They all got sick, and they were all in and out of Bellevue Hospital, but eventually four of them died. Minik's father, Kishuk, was the first to die. He died in February of 1898 in Bellevue.
And describe what happened then. How old was Minik? What did he understand?
Minik had been born, we're not sure of the date, but it was 1890 or 1891. So he was 7 or 8 years old at the time his father died. And the museum had a funeral for Kishuk, and Minik attended that funeral and saw his father buried on the grounds of the museum, or at least that's what he thought he saw, and that's what he believed he saw. Amazingly, though, that's not what happened. The museum staged a sham funeral for the sole purpose of deceiving young Minik into believing that his father had been buried, whereas in fact his father, after death, was dissected by Bellevue Hospital. His brain was taken and used for anthropological study. And then his body, or what was left of it, was sent to Cobleskill, New York, to what they called a macerating plant, a defleshing plant, run by William Wallace, who was a museum employee. They would take these bones, not just of people, but of animals as well, and they would deflesh them there and send back nice clean bones for exhibit in the museum.
And so Minnick's father, Kissick, his skeleton hung in the Museum of Natural History?
Yes. Some years later, Minnick experienced the trauma of discovering his father's skeleton on display in the Museum of Natural History. And this discovery happened sometime in January of 1906. Minnick had been in the United States for quite some time and was in his mid-teens when this discovery was made.
We're talking to Ken Harper, who has lived in the Arctic for over 30 years in various Inuit communities and has written this remarkable book, Give Me My Father's Body, The Life of Minnick, the New York Eskimo. How did Minnick discover that the skeleton he saw in the museum was his father's?
In my research, I uncovered a couple of reports of how he discovered this. One is that his schoolmates told him that his father's skeleton was on display in the museum, and he went and checked it out and discovered it to be true. And another report in the newspapers of the day was that Minnick was in the museum one day, because he was often in the museum, came around a corner and discovered it on display, made the discovery himself.
Now, the man who defleshed the bone, or his factory, William Wallace, he adopted Minnick, and Minnick took his name?
Yes, he did. In 1898, after four of the Inuit had died, the two survivors were Minnick and the young man Wisakasak. Wisakasak was sent back to Greenland in 1898 on a Peary ship. Minnick was kept in the United States, ultimately for 12 years, but the initial reason for keeping him was because Mrs. Jessup, the wife of the museum president, wanted to see if it was possible to educate a savage, and so Minnick was kept in New York. Now, the Jessups were a very affluent family. They didn't want to look after Minnick themselves, so they gave Minnick over to the care of William Wallace, who was the building superintendent at the museum. But he was much more than just the building superintendent. He was an entrepreneur in his own right. He had a couple of dairy farms and a boarding home up in Cobleskill, New York. And so he was living a very good life. The money was rolling in. He adopted, never officially, but he took Minnick into his care at the suggestion of the museum, and he came to love Minnick very much, as did his wife Retta Wallace. Minnick fitted in with the family and became one of them, and a real emotional bond was established between these people. That emotional bond developed, however, over time. But in 1898, when Kishuk had just died, Wallace was very much doing the bidding of Morris Jessup and the scientists at the museum. And Wallace was running this defleshing plant or macerating plant. And Wallace was party to all of these events, the sham funeral, the defleshing of the bones, and so on.
And did Minnick come to understand that?
Minnick came to understand that there had been a phony burial for the purpose of impressing him. He knew that Wallace had been involved in it. He remembered that Wallace had been involved in it. But he forgave Wallace for this. At the same time, after 1901, the Wallace Empire came tumbling down because William Wallace was fired by the museum in 1901. He had been found to be dishonest. As building superintendent, he was taking kickbacks from building contractors in return for granting them museum work. So his world came tumbling down. He lost his farms and his boarding house in Cobleskill, and eventually he lost the house in New York. In 1904, his wife Retta died, and he sent his own son, Willie, away to live with relatives, but he kept Minnick living with him. Now, Morris Jessup, the museum president, one of New York's wealthiest men, who, when he died in 1908, left a fortune in excess of $12 million, he simply refused to pay any more money for the upkeep and the education of Minnick, which was the promise that he had made to William Wallace.
But ultimately, Minnick went back to Greenland. When did that happen?
After Minnick discovered his father's skeleton on display in the museum, he went repeatedly to the museum and begged for his father's skeleton to be released and to be given a proper burial. And the museum always refused. So Minnick got very discouraged and decided that he wanted to return home to Greenland. In 1908, he asked Peary for passage north on Peary's ship, because the Peary ships were the only way of getting there. Peary refused in 1908. He said there wasn't room. I mean, how much room can one Inuit teenager take up? But there was no room, so Minnick was stuck for another year in New York. In 1909, after the publication of a newspaper article that embarrassed the Peary forces immensely, the Peary forces finally relented and agreed to send Minnick back north. There was a two-page newspaper article published called "Why Arctic Explorer Peary's Neglected Eskimo Boy Wants to Shoot Him." So this article finally convinced the Peary people. Peary had a very capable publicity machine working here in New York, the Peary Arctic Club. Herbert Bridgman, the publisher of the Brooklyn Eagle, was the main person there. And Peary was in the north, but Bridgman finally relented and agreed that Minnick would have to go north.
Ken Harper, author of Give Me My Father's Body, The Life of Minnick, the New York Eskimo. We will bring you the second part of this interview tomorrow and hear what happens when Minnick went back to Greenland and then came back to the United States, and how the Museum of Natural History tried to cover up what had happened to Minnick and his family. If you'd like to order a cassette copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230, 1-800-735-0230, and you can email us at mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams and Brad Simpson. Our engineer and music maestro is Anthony Sloan, our technical director, Errol Maitland. I've been told to acknowledge those who make Democracy Now! Possible. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting supports Pacifica Radio, and our thanks to Pacifica stations KPFA, KPFK, KPFT, WPFW, and WBAI. All of that means all of you. We are Pacifica. From the embattled sub-studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and The Fired, from the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!